Cannabis Business Minds, we train and mentor professionals, entrepreneurs, and aspiring entrepreneurs on how to confidently find their place in the legal cannabis and hemp industries. Come on and join us at CannabisBusinessMinds.com.
Hello, Cannabis Business Minds, and hope you're doing well. On today's episode, we get to hear from the executive director of the regulatory body in Michigan all about the Michigan cannabis market, his transition or the department's transition from, you know, being primarily a medical focused market to an adult use, and how quickly actually they did that transition, a little bit about what social equity programs are like right now in Michigan and the future of the department. We talk about sales, we talk about leadership, we talk about regulation, and it's a very jam-packed interview. This was taken in July during Cannabis Business Week. What's very interesting is I was just on the Michigan website, and when you look at sales reports for the month of August, right? So, you know, their adult use started relatively recently, right? And so when you look at the sales between medical use and adult use, just for the month of August, $49 million related to medical sales and about $53 million related to the adult use sales. Now, you guys know I love data. I'm very interested in product trends, all that kind of stuff. So what I did with this report is I just broke down kind of like what are the major categories. Well, you've guessed it, and you're going to hear it on a few of these other podcasts this month, but biggest category, 51% of that total sales, flower, right? So flower still is trending, and it's interesting to see if we can could compare that to different markets where that lies. So flower, next second largest one is vape, right? So vape crisis, that stuff is definitely kind of evolved and not kind of harming or hindering kind of consumer preferences there. And then edibles, you know, edibles, that makes sense. But there was two categories, and I want you to try to guess, and then I'll tell you in a second, that performed the least in both medical, like the worst, I suppose, the least, no, but the worst, as a percentage of total sales. And those categories were, drum roll, please. First one, I was actually pretty shocked because I thought it was something a little bit bigger than it was. Keef, from total sales of $49 million, only yielded $20,000 in the medical market. And then the second, and then in the adult use market, it yielded less than $10,000, right? So very, very small product category in Michigan. The next one that didn't perform so well was the infused non-edible liquid. Y'all, I'm a little bit curious, like, what is that? Are those considered beverages? Which usually is a kind of poor performing category. So it's very interesting to see. I think before we get into the interview, I want to empower you for whatever state that you are working in, if you're a consultant or if you're that business operator, is are you utilizing the data that has been given to you to make valid decisions, right? And so just a challenge for you there. But before that challenge can exist wherever you want. But the big takeaway from this interview for me was just the power of our voice and the power to create dynamic relationships real time with regulators that are just trying to understand this industry just as much as we are. So I hope you enjoy the show.
Cannabis Business Week, which is part of the Cannabis Business Minds podcast. One of the things that I really wanted to bring everybody in this interview was an overview of what's happening in other markets. We focus so much on California. We focus so much on basically the West Coast, and we haven't had an opportunity to understand anything that's happening beyond the West Coast. And I wanted to get you on, Andrew, not only because Michigan is such a big market, but you've been responsible for leading that transition from, you know, no regulation to medical regulation to adult use to social equity to where we are today in kind of in a pandemic. So I'm very happy to get you on Cannabis Business Minds. So welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being on. I always like to talk about where Michigan stands when we look at you know, the national market here, you know, in the U.S., because I do think that sometimes states like Michigan, all of us in the Midwest, the flyover states, if you will, sometimes get forgotten. But it is a pretty big market, and things are really starting to pick up in the Midwest overall, and particularly in Michigan.
I'm really excited to kind of get down into the nitty gritty a little bit through this episode. I remember doing my research about Michigan a few years ago, and it's the second largest medical market after California. So I'm assuming probably the second largest adult use market as well. Is that accurate?
No, not quite. Michigan had a huge medical market. I think we had a simple registration process, from 2008 to 2016, we only had a patient and caregiver market. There was no commercial market at all. And we had almost 300,000 patients in Michigan. And I think not because necessarily the demand was greater in Michigan, you know, sort of proportionate to the population of the state, but we had a very simple registration process, kind of a low barrier to entry. Our ballot initiative, so we had a tremendous number of patients. And interestingly, what we've seen is the commercial market has started to evolve. Our number of registered patients has declined fairly significantly just in a little over a year, or I should say a little less than a year, where we've had a commercial adult use market in the state. Now we've shrunk from about 295,000 patients to about 245,000 patients.
Wow. And do you have any insight as to why that is? Is it just that it's more readily available, so somebody doesn't have to go renew their medical license, or have what kind of analysis has been done?
Yeah, I think it's mostly because of accessibility in the adult use market. I think we have a lot of individuals who were using, you know, marijuana for medicinal purposes, but lighter medicinal purposes, not so much cancer patients. Mm-hmm. Some of the more serious ailments, but, you know, for stress relief and things like that, pain relief, who now can just access it through the adult use market. So there's no need for them to have the registry card or visit a physician any longer. And so they've just moved over into the adult use market.
Yeah. I always think about like my mom, like she would never have registered for, based in Oregon, right? Never registered for a medical card, but would be open to an adult use. And I think that's kind of the beauty of adult use, is that it allows people who have been a little bit afraid of what this market could be to say, oh, it's a little bit more normalized. I'm going to try this a little bit more. So,
I think a lot of people who they're not, because marijuana is still illegal at the federal level in the U.S., they don't necessarily want their name on a government list of individuals who have access to products. And in the adult use market, there's no tracking. It's more like a normal transaction. So they're more comfortable that way. And, you know, we sort of standardize product availability between the medical and adult use markets here. So there's not a lot of differentiation through the products. But you get a little bit of a tax break if you're purchasing in the medical market, because there's no 10% excise tax. So that there's some incentive to stay there, on top of the fact that the pricing is still significantly lower in the medical market than the adult use market here in Michigan.
Okay, it is a little bit lower. Interesting. And is that for every type of product category?
Well, we track the flower price per ounce as sort of our benchmark, and the wholesale price of flower as well. So yeah, I think that would translate through. But the demand in the adult use market, which is relatively new, we've only had sales in Michigan since December 1st of last year. Demand is so much higher than supply at this point that the price point is very high. I mean, the operators can essentially charge whatever they want because people have a thirst for those products that are newly available. Whereas on the medical side, supply is a little closer to meeting demand. Supply is increasing in the medical market. Demand is coming down since the patients are being reduced. So prices are much more reasonable, but we still see the number of patients dwindling over time.
Well, our last guest yesterday talked to us about the Washington market. He'd been working in it for since it went through kind of its transitionary period. And one graph that he showed everybody was how he believes Washington is going to kind of set the average for what the price or the average kind of order would be, or the average basket in that case was. And it was drastically lower than any of the other states. Michigan wasn't included. It was Washington, California, Oregon, and I believe Nevada, but it was just substantially lower. So I'm curious at what point, because you're right, it's about supply and it's about demand and kind of the laws of economics here. But I'm curious what it would be in the next few years.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to tell, but if we look at per ounce in the medical market, just this year, we've seen it's kind of fluctuated, but it's come down about $10 an ounce. Whereas in the adult use market, from the beginning. So in January, it's already come down over $100 an ounce. So just as supplies started to increase, and I should say in January, there were a very limited number of places to get access to products at the beginning of the market. But you know, where it lands, it's kind of tough to say. You know, and I think there's so many market factors to consider. Michigan was the first state to have a law on the books that legalized adult use marijuana, but Illinois is right behind. Sales in Illinois have actually outpaced Michigan slightly to this point. But a lot of the, you know, the market demand is coming not only from Michigan, but we have a lot of border states that don't have any product access at all. If you look at Ohio and Indiana and Wisconsin up to the north. So that's going to drive a lot of demand. So as we see markets expand and other states that surround Michigan eventually, presumably coming online and allowing for legal access, that will affect the price points of Michigan as well. So, you know, the dynamics and the volatility of the marijuana market are often unpredictable. So I hate to even put numbers on it because it just makes me foolish a year from now when I was way off base.
Right. Well, and I was just so curious because it seems like Michigan follows, you know, what I can talk to the most is obvious California, that it follows some of the ways that structuring of licenses have been, right? So it seems like in Michigan, you have to have local approval from a city or a county before you can get a state license. Am I accurate in that?
Correct. Yes. It's a little bit different in the medical and adult use, but in essence, yes. Local municipalities control whether they want facilities to be located there and whether they want certain types or how many. And then at the state level, we use that as one criteria for eligibility for the state license.
Wow. Well, could you just talk to us a little bit about the ecosystem of how it all worked? Because I think what's fascinating, and it seems like states are going to continue to follow this, medical pass, adult use will soon follow. But with that, I mean, even looking at the different licensing, you've got a provisioning center for the medical market, but you've got a retail dispensary for the adult use market. So before this, I pulled the Excel spreadsheets. I was like, let me see if I can cross-reference, like, can people have a license for either one? Could you just kind of break down that? Like, what is the ecosystem like?
So the medical market's a little more mature and there are 1,773 municipalities in Michigan. So all those local units of government that have to have some form of approval for those facilities to exist. Those municipalities, only 145 have opted in to allow facilities in the medical market. So still a vast minority of municipalities where you can even locate a facility. And on the adult use side, it's even less, only 61 so far who allow for facilities. So some of the major metro areas in the adult use market still aren't online. So Detroit is the biggest city of Michigan. If you're not from Michigan, Detroit's probably the only city in Michigan you've ever heard of, unless you remember all your state capitals, which is Lansing in Michigan. So it's still really in its infancy, and we don't have access in most areas of the state still. And Michigan is a very politically diverse state. Again, most people probably heard of Detroit if you're not from Michigan. But we have major metro centers that are largely historically built on manufacturing, but a lot of the state is still very agricultural if you get to the northern lower peninsula or in the upper peninsula. So, you know, though there are areas of the state that are still kind of on the fence about marijuana overall. Sort of this quasi-agricultural manufacturing sort of industry. So I think Michigan is very well positioned to be a leader in that space because the skill sets of the citizens and the history of Michigan really lend itself to being successful in this industry. But it's still a very sensitive political topic to get into. So we still see most places don't have those facilities. So what we've seen is those municipalities that allowed for medical first to then move over into adult use. Most of the facility operators that got into the medical market did so with plans to immediately transition into the adult use market. A lot of people were surprised how quickly we made the transition from medical to adult use. So we went medical commercially in 2016. It took us a year to set the program up. So we had our first licenses issued in 2017 and our first sales later that year, in 2018. And then the ballot initiative passed for adult use, another year to set that program up. But I think a lot of people were thinking we would have somewhere between 2 and 4 years of that medical market to become solidified and really entrenched before the adult use market was layered on top, but it came right away. So a lot of municipalities were still in conversations about how to address the medical market, and now you have the adult use market thrust upon them as well. And you know, if you are on a local township board, it's not a major city council, but a local township board, a township has, you know, 1,000 residents, and so you have a few people that devote a couple hours a month to working on this township board, and all of a sudden you're thrust into the middle of this highly politicized issue. You have, you know, multi-million dollar, multi-state operator companies coming in and pitching their wares and wanting you to adopt an ordinance. A lot of these, they don't have legal counsel that help these township or small city village councils. So they're kind of dealing with all of these issues, trying to figure out how to move ahead. And in many cases, the best thing for them to do was just to wait and see and try and figure out what it was going to look like, determine what best practices are. When I talk to municipal associations, they're often asking me, how should we do this? What should our ordinance look like? And, you know, from the state level, I can't give them guidance on what's best for their municipality. So often they're left trying to figure this out on their own. So I think that's led to some of the slow growth, but most of the market now, you know, we do have some large vertically integrated operators. We have some smaller independent retail operators, but largely it's the sites that had medical turned in and now they're doing multi-purpose. We don't have a lot of independent sites doing adult use sales that weren't already in the medical market. Okay. And we continue to see it unfold that way. And I think we'll start to see more and more municipalities start to participate as well.
So from like a brick and mortar perspective, if could you have a one location that would be a provisioning center as well as the retail?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. That is so fascinating. I think that that's the one thing I've learned being in this space is that from a regulatory perspective, you can't flex a lot. You can't guide when you might want to guide. So what other educational ways are people or authorities doing? Sorry, that was my espresso maker. I had to have one. What are other kind of, I just find that quite frustrating, right? And I guess I'm going to lead into that question because one of the areas, again, comparing what I know, California, of an illicit market that has continued was because a lot of the localities didn't get on board and haven't got on board. So how do you prioritize as the leader of this organization to, when you can't really incentivize them or give them guidance on that, like how does that even work?
So we've had a focus from the beginning on outreach and education and collaboration. Mm-hmm. I think that the more we can inform about what the state level program looks like, the better informed decisions other governmental entities or business operators can make. They need to understand what's going on at the state level. So we've tried to over-communicate, tried to, you know, provide a pathway that so everyone can understand where we are now and where we're heading in the future so they can make appropriate plans. It can be challenging because it's such a dynamic market and things change overnight. So I've been doing this since 2016 now. And I can look back to 2016, Andrew, and just say, oh, you poor boy, you have no idea what you've gotten yourself into, and you have no idea what you're talking about at this point. Now, if you go back and watch videos of me, I'm going to sound like I know everything, but I really didn't, you know, looking back and say, I didn't know that much. But you almost have to do it. There's no template. I mean, to your point, we looked at other states. We looked at Colorado and Washington and Oregon and California and looked to see what they did. We have great relationships with my counterparts in those states, so they could give me their lessons learned. But ultimately, until you get into it, it's hard to see how it's going to unfold. And because it's done state by state, the way in which we do it is nuanced enough that there's no template to follow. We keep learning as we go, but we try to over-communicate. We try and bring in people from the industry, from local units of government, so we can understand their perspective to inform decision-making. So as best we can provide a pathway forward. And one of the things that I've learned is not to overcorrect. We have to let some of the decisions we make breathe a little bit, see what the outcomes are, and then we can tweak it later on. And when you're making decisions at a governmental level that impact markets so much, which isn't typical for a regulator, I've been a regulator for 15 years or so, and usually we're not controlling market factors. We're looking at making decisions to ensure public health, safety, and welfare, to ensure that we have a business-friendly environment as long as it's not impacting public health, safety, and welfare. But in this space, we are making a lot of decisions that directly impact those market factors. So whenever we make one of those decisions, it's making someone happy and someone else really mad.
Yeah.
And really be lobbied by people who aren't benefiting from certain decisions to change your mind. And we've got to let things continue to move forward and see how it works. I think largely we've been successful there, but we're going to continue to bring in diversity in terms of perspectives to inform our perspectives so we can try and do it as best we can. And when we we've done something that doesn't work, being able to admit and saying, yeah, this is what we made this decision. This was the outcome we were hoping for. It's not what we got. So we're going to move a different direction.
Yeah. I mean, I just think about how, and it's really hard to compare this space to any other industry, and the fact that, you know, one small change in how you have packaging or one small change of what your lab testing requirements, that can completely disrupt any business. And knowing that, you know, I like that mentality of, you know, let's like wait and see and really kind of consider the business owners at stake here, because they're already facing so many issues of, A, they're starting up their business. B, it's federally illegal, so they don't have a lot of capital, or they pay all these taxes. So I think that's very, I think people should model that. And it's interesting because when I was looking at your bio and the mission, it looks like your organization, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, how did you actually get started in 2016 in this? And what did you do as a leader to say, okay, well, let's actually put this regulation in. But your mission is to try to be the kind of the source of what it could look like on a national level, like to be that, you know, case study of, well, we did it well and people were successful and businesses were successful. So can you talk to us about that transition period? Because you had spent time in government. You said 15 years you've been in the government. You know, how has that been getting into cannabis? You alluded to it a little bit, but if you could walk us through that.
So I worked in gaming in the start of my career. So we have three state regulated casinos in Detroit, and my first job in state government was working there. And I sort of stayed in licensing and regulation since then. I got into management at the Secretary of State, which is like the DMV in Michigan, and started working in licensing and regulatory affairs. I did occupational and public health licensing for a few years. Mm-hmm. So and in the medical marijuana program, that caregiver patient registry, was within the same agency that I worked in, but I wasn't working there. When the law appeared to be passing for the commercialization of the industry, it was viewed at the time largely as we needed someone who could set it up that knew how to run licensing programs and knew how to process applications, how to write regulations. And I was around, and frankly, I like to think it was some sort of, you know, coronation, that this was the culmination of my career. But the reality was it had to be done quickly. And I was there at the time, and they said, Andrew, why don't you do it? And I said, okay, I'm willing to help out. And then when I started working on it, it was temporary. And then I just kind of stuck around. And I think because it's sort of a happy accident in that since I was there, and it became very clear that it was unique and you couldn't sort of throw someone into it midstream, I just stuck with it. And I've really enjoyed doing it. I've always had a passion for public policy. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to work in the public sector. I think, you know, we need people who...
Do you need help with 280E strategy, cannabis regulation, and making sure that your accounting, your inventory, your cash management are all squared away for your cannabis business? Well, if you do, I've got you covered. Head on over to Cannabis Business Minds and check out Cannabis Finance Bootcamp, an online training that gives you the tools, the templates to help you in your cannabis business and your cannabis business needs. And because you're a podcast listener, you can enter in the promo code CBM2030 when you head over to checkout, and you get $25 off your purchase price.
Who are diligent and hardworking to work in the public sector. The money's obviously in the private sector, but you know, the citizens need to be represented in some of these processes when it comes to regulating industries and ensuring public health, safety, and welfare. So I really enjoyed it, but it was not by design, I assure you. I just, you know, things moved so quickly, and I was the guy who was in the place at the time, so I just kept running with it. And I'd been around the department that's sort of our umbrella agency. So I knew a lot of people I could pull into it that had certain expertise in IT systems and writing regulations and things like that. So I think it was really beneficial to have been around for a while and know the people. And I've always been a big mission guy. I think when you look at an agency, we have about 135 people who work at our agency that, you know, you start to get too big to micromanage everyone and make all the decisions yourself. When we started, there were about six of us. So I had my hands in every single little decision that was being made. But now, obviously, that's not practical. So I want my staff to understand when they're working day to day, they need to think that it's not just good enough to complete the tasks. Are we doing this in such a way that other states and agencies can look at us as the way to get things done? And I want them to be infused with that mission, so they're considering that in all their decision-making processes. And you know, I think we've been very successful in timely implementing the programs. It's not that we haven't made some mistakes that we've had to correct, but you know, I think there's a way we can get this done so that we can be forward-thinking as a governmental agency, which isn't typical of government. You know, largely you're dealing with the problems of today and putting out fires. But when it comes to this industry, that the time is now to sort of position ourselves and position the businesses in the state to be successful. So even though I get some pushback, we have pretty strict, I'll take testing standards as an example. We have pretty strict testing standards in Michigan that are more stringent than a lot of other states, maybe any other state in certain aspects. But I'm trying to think ahead to what will federal standards look like? When we look at analogous industries and testing standards for other products, you know, the FDA regulates or USDA regulates, have some national framework. Are our businesses going to be meeting the standards that will be expected of states when that transition eventually occurs, so that they can operate immediately in a regional and national market without completely retooling how they operate? So we're all looking ahead to that and trying to make decisions that best position everyone to be continually successful, regardless of what the framework looks like at the state or the federal level.
Yeah, I think that's great. And it's almost that you had your own experience of a startup organization, right? Like you grew it from 6 people to now 100 and really having to instill like, hey, not only do we need to know this regulation, but let's really run this in a very powerful way. Because that's one of the things, like I look at organizational design in businesses and thinking, well, sometimes the biggest problem is that the employees don't have job clarity. They are very confused about what's going on. And that then leaves them feeling disengaged or disempowered. And then your whole mission of what you're trying to accomplish usually suffers. And I think that, unfortunately, in government, you have that feeling a lot that, you know, people are just, you know, at their desk and just pushing a button and not super engaged or happy. And I think that shows how you've been able to influence that, which is very important.
Well, we've been in kind of a unique position. We have a lot of young people who work at our agency are very hungry and passionate. And because we did start it from the ground up, I was able to handpick some of my leadership team, people I knew that were successful, that had good ideas, that weren't just, you know, the check in a chair type of people that really wanted to work hard. And it was desirable for a lot of people to come work here because it is a new and interesting idea. I spent my entire career administering laws that were written in the 80s or earlier and trying to retread. And a lot of it is trying to figure out, okay, what did they do in the past and why do they do it? And how can we legally defend, you know, what we're doing now? But getting to lay it all out and having an influence on what the laws look like and to write regulations from, you know, a blank sheet of paper to build all that out is something exciting for me. And I think it's exciting for a lot of the people I work with. It's very rare in government you get to do something brand new.
Yeah.
Has kind of been done before, but this is brand new, and this is sort of a legacy project for a lot of the people who work at our agency. And we know that we're going to be a part of something that's going to be, you know, in the infrastructure of Michigan industry for the foreseeable future. And we get to say we were there at the beginning.
Yeah. I want to, you know, quickly just finish our kind of discussion on licensing. You know, seeing that there's a significant percentage of the counties and the municipalities that haven't passed anything, you know, one thing I was surprised about to learn yesterday that in Washington, the government actually put a moratorium on licenses. So for certain license types, you're not able to apply for them anymore. How does it work, or what are the plans in Michigan? Is it an open amount that people can apply, or how does it fully work?
We are restricted in the law from putting any sort of caps on licenses. So at the state level, we have the sort of minimum barriers to entry, and anyone who meets those minimum barriers is eligible for a license. But yeah, the controlling factor, to your point, is largely municipal participation.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a matter of time as municipalities look at the issues, get a better understanding as the market evolves, what their you know, what the tax collection is going to look like, and therefore what their percentage is going to be. You know, when they wrote the law, they built in tax incentives for municipalities. They get a certain distribution, but if they can't put a figure on that to know how many dollars are going to come back to their community, it's hard for them to make that argument when they're trying to pass an ordinance. So I think it just takes a little bit of time still for it to be normalized, for everyone to understand. I think the conversation was moving there, and there was a level of comfort with medical. But as I said, then adult use came in right behind it. we like to call it adult use. Everyone else calls it recreational. That has a completely different tone to it. And yeah. I think scared some municipal officials off. And when you're an elected official and you're dealing with some of these issues, you know, you're trying to represent your constituency, and marijuana is a very easy one just to keep an arm's length away from because there's no right decision making. No one is ambivalent about marijuana. They're either pro or they're against. And trying to make, you know, rational, nuanced, middle of the road decisions sort of makes enemies of everyone. And that's the worst thing to do if you're in a political atmosphere, because it's hard to get reelected. So I think it's going to take a little bit of time, but we're slowly getting there. We're offering ourselves as a resource to make sure everyone understands what the state level program's supposed to look like. And you know, there haven't been some of the problems that were of primary concern when we launched the market. There's not a lot of diversion. There's not this tremendous amount of youth access to products that shouldn't be there. If anything, our biggest illicit concern has been the continued operation of the illicit market, which we know all states deal with. And inversion of product to Michigan. Demand exceeds supply. And if you look out at the West Coast, there's plenty of supply. And so they try and get it here. So that's been the biggest sort of law enforcement concern. And the best way to counter that is to offer reasonably priced, fully tested products to consumers at licensed operations in the state, because that's the easiest form of access and it's the legal form of access, and then they can get the best products without having to rely on the black market.
Yeah, I think consumer education is the biggest area that everybody, businesses and regulators, need to focus on, because even thinking about the localities, if you can educate a consumer, like, these could be the benefits. This is, you know, what cannabis, or, you know, and I have a question about cannabis versus marijuana in Michigan. This is what cannabis can be doing. All of that, that to me would at least open up some possibility for the constituents then to influence, I think, the township leadership. So it's interesting that way. Had there been any PSA public service announcements in, like, and I don't know the law in terms of regulation, if that's even possible, but you know how there was like the Got Milk campaign, obviously, you know, I grew up with that kind of campaign. Has there been anything in Michigan to make that a little bit more curious for somebody who might not even understand what cannabis or marijuana is?
Yeah, I think things moved too fast for a lot of that education to occur, but it was a ballot initiative. So there was a lot of messaging on both sides when the ballot initiative was out there in 2018, to educate consumers on what that vote would really mean. And one interesting byproduct of that, because our adult use ballot initiative passed with about 63% in favor in Michigan. And that ballot initiative also included a local referendum provision. So at least 5% of the voters in the last general election signed a petition. They could press a local ordinance via a referendum, so a vote of the citizens. And some of the activists then, after the law passed, went to some of those communities that had high rates of support for state ballot initiative and tried to run those ballot referendums at the local level, and they all failed, which very interesting. So the voters in a community all voted in favor of the state law, but then voted against a local ordinance to authorize facilities. And I think the biggest thing, that lesson we can take from that, is in the minds of the voters, there was a much different, it was a much different argument to say, should it be legalized so people don't go to jail for possessing marijuana? Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you want storefront in your community? No. So those is two very different things. So I think some of that education has to be, and I will say this, I think it has to be done in person. When I talk to industry operators who are concerned about lack of participation at the municipal level, I always say, how many state legislators or local leaders have you had into your stores and other communities so they can see what it looks like? Because I think in their mind's eye, because we had a lot of dispensaries in Michigan before legalizing the commercial industry, and they were exactly what you think they would look like when they're operating in a gray market.
Yeah.
And stores look like here now. They're very professionally operated. You know, the grow operations and the processors, you wouldn't even know they were there. Mm-hmm. Retail storefronts are fairly muted. And I think in the mind's eye of a lot of these municipal officials, they're picturing, you know, huge, neon green marijuana leaves everywhere. And, you know, lines of people sitting along the curb smoking joints. And it's just not what it looks like, but they don't know that because they haven't seen it. So I think the industry is trying to get up and running. They certainly need to advocate for themselves. But even in the few number of municipalities that are operating now, we don't quite have saturation in those markets yet. So there hasn't been a business need to start advocating in a lot of other places yet. But I think that's the next wave. That's what has to come.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it's we have a lot of parallel things happening at the same time. And as one starts to press another, I think the industry, when they've saturated the markets that are participating, they're going to have to find somewhere else to go. And that's when a lot of that advocacy at the local level is really going to start to press.
Yeah. And one last question, is there about licensing, is there a delivery component to the licensing in Michigan?
Yeah, we've allowed delivery since some of the early regulations. So almost from the beginning in the medical market, it's carried over to the adult use market as well. And that sort of feeds into that philosophy that if you want to tamp down the illicit market, access for consumers has to be just as simple as it would be in the illicit market.
Yeah.
That was an important component. There are some restrictions around it, you know, to sort of prevent any additional crime or diversion or inversion, but we have a lot of it for quite a while.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. Social equity. Social equity is a big deal, especially right now. You know, there's been several programs in some of the states. I was shocked to see that of the states that have medical and adult use programs, less than 10 actually have social equity programs. And so it's really nice to see that, you know, Michigan has been working and doing stuff related to social equity. Could you talk, has that program been fully executed and what's going on with social equity in Michigan?
So we've had it in place with the implementation of the adult use regulatory program. Mm-hmm. Team of five staff who are dedicated completely to the social equity program as resources to our social equity applicants. And then we also have a number of fee reductions. So the way we implemented in Michigan is we identified communities that were disproportionately impacted by war on drugs, if you will. So those that had higher than the median conviction rates for mm-hmm. marijuana related offenses, and then I had at least initially 30% or more of the population that lived below the federal poverty limit, and now mm-hmm. we're at the 20%. So out of those 1,773 municipalities in Michigan, we're up to 184 now that qualify under the program. So residents of those communities are eligible, depending on their circumstance, for up to 75% off all the fees that we charge at the state level. We've had quite a lot of, we've done a lot of presentations, mm-hmm. and that team of staff is available as a resource directly to those social equity applicants. You know, we have a lot of work to still do. We have 220 individuals who have applied to qualify for the social equity program, mm-hmm. But out of the 283 licenses we've issued, only three of them have been to social equity. So we're sort of losing them somewhere between submitting that application for social equity and the application for licensure. So we recently did a survey of those applicants to see what the barriers were. And the three biggest, which were all in about the 20% range, we looked at the biggest barrier. One was the pandemic. One was local participation. So they wanted to operate a municipality that didn't allow for facilities yet. And then the third was access to capital. And that's been something we've been concerned about all along. We looked at a potential funding source to give grants to social equity applicants, somewhere between $15,000 to $25,000, and I'd hope to give that to them for the first 5 years of operation. But those 25% or so that said capital was the biggest barrier, we followed up and said, "How much money do you need?" And the average amount was somewhere between $300,000 to $500,000. So, you know, for us to give them $15,000, I'm sure they'd appreciate it, but really not going to get them over the hurdles that they need in order to start their business. So we have to continue to brainstorm new ideas. One of the areas we're going to be most effective is that we require every licensee to have their own social equity plan. Partnering with a lot of the industry operators and establishing mentorship and incubator programs will be very beneficial, and maybe even establishing some business partnerships. We've seen several of our licensees who are actually providing direct funding, paying the fees for the social equity applicants, or offering grants, considering ancillary businesses as well. Job creation. We're actually going to host a job fair for licensees that have indicated part of their social equity program is to hire individuals from those disproportionately impacted communities. I see. So there are a lot of ways we're trying to offer benefits, but the one piece that we haven't overcome yet. And speaking with my counterparts in other states, we're all in the same boat. How do you get licenses in the hands of these individuals from these communities? That's very challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you can tune in, we're talking to Kareem Webb at 5 p.m. 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So he ran an incubator in Los Angeles and put through several people through the program for social equity. So we're going to learn a little bit about kind of what he did. But I think the big thing is, yeah, it's capital. It's, you know, women and minorities have had a very hard, it's very hard to get access to capital. And when you start a cannabis business, if it's a retail or even if it's a cultivation, like the startup costs at minimum are about $500,000. And then you factor in 280E, and depending on what the tax is at the local or the state level, you know, we've seen it with the big companies going out of business. So I think there is a very interesting, I don't know what the solution is, but it would be interesting to also participate in that. But if there was a funding source, which we all know that cannabis is a great kind of industry to be in, that would be it. And then I think a very tight monitoring of the budget, right? Because I think what happens with a lot of the businesses that have unfortunately gone out of business is that they didn't know how to run a business. They didn't realize where to put the funds.
Yeah. We had the idea from the very beginning to have dedicated resources. So our staff act as almost navigators for the licensing process. Okay. But as complicated as a licensing process might be, it's probably the least complicated aspect of starting a cannabis business. And we do not have the expertise. And when my staff was meeting individually with these folks, a lot of the insight that they needed were business decisions to be made, which, you know, we really can't give them legal advice as a government agency, on top of the fact that we really just don't know what the best decision might be. And I think you're right. When you're talking about women or minority-owned businesses, some of the concerns I've heard is it's not just about access to capital even. It's how do you navigate the process of acquiring real estate? Getting, we can't get loans from the bank in this industry, but, you know, getting access to capital through local politics. When you're looking at disproportionately impacted individuals, they've been sort of kept out of those systems for years and years. And so to just say, well, now we changed our mind, the law says, you know, we're going to give you licenses, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And one of the things that I'm working on, we've had social equity work groups, but I'm starting a new panel to develop policy ideas that are specifically focused on racial equity and diversity and inclusion in the industry. We can think beyond our role as an administrator of laws and escalate some policy ideas to our legislature to say, okay, these are some practical ideas that will be truly effective in leveling the playing field. Our preliminary data is very preliminary, but when we look at individuals who have an ownership interest in an adult use facility and demographics of Michigan and comparing it, we're well below sort of a representative population of cannabis business owners. So only 4% are Black, 0% are Hispanic or Latino. So we need to make better progress in ensuring that ownership in this industry is, you know, more representative of the population, especially considering that 60% of the people who, you know, were incarcerated for marijuana-related offenses federally were Black or Latino.
No, absolutely. Do you... if people wanted to find out more about that, where could they go? Because I know that there's even some people in the Facebook group that are in Michigan, and I posted some stuff about social equity, but where could people go to, you know, find out a little bit more or like listen in on some of these discussions and maybe even provide some of their own insight if they had some?
So we publish everything at our website at michigan.gov/MRA. That's sort of our one-stop shop. I think we've retooled the website a few times, but I think now it's quite easy to navigate. You tell me if you went to it recently. I think it's a sharp-looking website. We publish everything there, so we have guidance documents as well as contact information. I'm always open to meeting with groups and individuals that have new and innovative ideas on some of these keystone issues that we're working on. So as I said, part of that collaborative approach is listening to all ideas out there and informing my perspective when it comes to how we can be more effective at these social equity and racial equity issues.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. And we had a few questions from the audience a little bit before during social media. One was, you know, related to just being, you being in this industry for you know, I guess since 2016 is like, you see a lot of businesses, you see a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, what's one piece of advice that you could give somebody like getting into this space?
Play the long game and don't buy into this concept that I think that people assumed in the beginning that if they had a license, they couldn't help but to be successful because there's so much money flying around, but it's more complicated than you might think. You know, regulatory compliance is challenging in this industry more so than any that I've regulated before. And with the tax implications, with the way 280E plays out at the federal level, profit margins at this point in the marijuana industry in Michigan are extremely slim. So while you may have a lot of cash flow, you don't necessarily get to keep a lot of that money. And when we were looking at the social equity program specifically, we looked at federal data and saw that, you know, 50% of small businesses fail within the first 5 years. That's not marijuana, that's overall. So it's not easy to start a business in the first place, let alone if your effective tax rate at the federal level is like 70%.
Yeah.
So you really need to think long and hard about how to get in and go slow. We've already seen some businesses in Michigan, even in the first couple of years, expand too quickly and then the bottom falls out. We're starting to see that happen in more mature markets like Canada or like California, mm-hmm. where, you know, you get overextended because it seems like you can't lose and then the bottom falls out. And because you don't have access to capital through traditional means, you know, going to the bank to get a loan, a lot of what we've seen in Michigan is as people work through the process, they have to keep bringing on new owners, new investors, because they have to keep increasing capital to get to the point of actually being productive and start to make a profit. So, you know, good planning is critical. I'm sure that's true in every business, but I think particularly in this space.
Yeah. Oh, that's great advice. What motivates you to work hard?
You know, I've always had sort of that civil servant mindset. You know, I take it very seriously that I'm in a position that affects 10 million people every day. All the citizens of the state of Michigan rely on those of us who work in the public sector to do good work. And so I take very seriously my responsibility to represent their interests and ensure that, you know, on those two arms of our mission, that the public is protected and they can, ensuring that the products they're accessing through the regulated market are as safe as possible. And where possible, then creating a regulatory environment that allows businesses to grow and succeed and create jobs and, you know, create tax revenue for the state. So I just always like being a public servant. I think we have a great deal of responsibility to serve the public in this capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. Last but not least, where do you see cannabis being when it's federally legal?
Well, I think if we look at what happened in the hemp market, we may mm-hmm. be able to learn something from that. So I think we're too far along in a state-by-state model for there to be sort of a federal framework. I think what's more likely is we'll see sort of federal decriminalization of some type and some baseline standards that states will have to meet. And I think that could be in various different agencies. You may see agricultural standards, so for the cultivators coming out of the USDA, and then you may see, you know, edible-infused product standards coming out of the FDA. And these programs will just have to ensure that those baseline standards are met. I think that's a reasonably sensible model, and then it'll just be handled at a state-by-state level.
Excellent. Andrew, thank you so much for sharing your insight on Cannabis Business Mind.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and if you enjoyed this, leave us a 5-star review. Make sure that you share this episode on your social media and tag us in the Instagram stories. You can find us wherever you go on social media. Just look up Cannabis Business Minds. Have an idea for the show or something that you want to talk about? Shoot us an email at podcast@cannabisbusinessminds.com.